Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog.
For a free trial and 30% off your new account for 3 months, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code FILM3.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Walt Disney once said, "Animation can explain whatever the mind of man can conceive." On this episode, we'll see what writer, director, and animator Andrew Stanton had in mind when making his new live-action film, John Carter. We'll also get his contributions for a top five that would make Uncle Walt proud.
Make him proud or have him spinning in his grave. We'll just have to take our chances with the Film Spotting top five this week. Traditionally animated movies. Josh, those are hand-drawn, classical, old school, whatever you want to call it. We'll share our favorites and Andrew Stanton's favorites later in the show.
But first, Adam's conversation with the director of Finding Nemo and WALL-E about his first filmmaking foray outside the animation world, John Carter.
When I saw you, I believed that something new can come into this world.
You are John Carter of Earth?
Yes, ma'am. What happened to this place?
A new power threatens to destroy our city.
That don't look like a fair fight.
You are ugly, but you are beautiful.
You will fight for us!
John Carter is the tale of a former Confederate captain who becomes entangled in another civil war when he's mysteriously transported to the planet Mars, or Barzum, as inhabitants call it. The story is taken from Edgar Rice Burroughs' 11-volume Barzum series, which first appeared in serial form in 1912. I talked with John Carter's director and co-writer recently and started by asking him to paint a picture for us of the young Andrew Stanton, the 10-year-old kid in the mid-70s who just discovered the strange, exciting world of Barzum.
Well, you have to picture this towhead albino kid who probably had a bowl haircut. And I always drew all the time, and my brothers drew, so that was sort of our thing we did. And then I had a friend that also drew, and he had brothers that were always drawing stuff, you know, spaceships, cartoons, monsters, and that was sort of our currency of getting along. And I remember being over at my friend's house, and his brother was drawing this 10-foot-tall forearm tusked character, and I thought it was the coolest looking thing. And they explained to me that it was a Thark, and that it came from these Marvel comic books. Marvel had just put out this limited series of comic books based on Edgar Rice Burroughs' Barzum series about a character named John Carter who mysteriously finds himself on Mars. So me not being the biggest reader, that was my gateway in. I went into the comic books, but then within, I think, the same month, I then went to the book itself. And the book is called A Princess of Mars. And there's actually 11 books that Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote. People don't know Burroughs well with that series. They know him well for Tarzan and all the Tarzan series that he wrote. But he actually wrote this series first, or at least the first couple books, before he got into Tarzan, and that made him a multimillionaire.
One of the things I found fascinating, as you mentioned drawings as well, I read, and is this really true, that you and the other screenwriters, Mark Andrews and Michael Chabon, actually had drawings? You had all done drawings as kids.
Yeah, this is after we had already agreed to be writing together, and we all claimed to have had a childhood love of the property, and that we had all grown up just as fans hoping to go see it on the screen someday. And in our initial sort of meetings together, suddenly to sort of outdo each other, it's like sort of like trying to prove your scars on the orca in Jaws. You know, we're all trying to say how much of a fan we were more than another.
Right.
We all ended up admitting that we had drawn drawings of the characters, and then we all had them. We had all saved them, or at least one or two of them, and we could bring them in and show them to each other. So it was a bit of fate. It was sort of like destiny meant we all had to work on it, and it was like a little club. Like, nobody can write on this picture unless they can truly prove they were a lifelong fan.
I'm going to show my ignorance, unfortunately, here of the Edgar Rice Burroughs serials. I was completely unfamiliar with this world before seeing your movie, but one of the things I imagine had to interest you about this movie now, and maybe then, about this subject matter, is that the main character is a storyteller. You have young Edgar Rice Burroughs being
Yes.
told a story, and John Carter is obviously the author of this tale. And I don't know how much of that comes from this story, how much of that was your invention, but if it was part of the original serial, how much do you think it affected your desire to eventually become a storyteller?
I don't know if it affected me about wanting to be a storyteller. If it did, it was unconscious. But what it did was it was an incredibly inviting device. It is in the book that it is told through his nephew. Edgar Rice Burroughs put himself in the book as a character that this story is passed down to. And it really intrigued me as a great device from a writer's standpoint when we were looking at it now. Michael Shaiman and I would talk about it. We said, you know, it's the equivalent of the device of somebody in a bar going, you know, this didn't happen to me, but it happened to my best friend, so let me tell you this. And somehow it really hooks you and pulls you in. We just thought it was really fitting to keep it.
One of the, I guess, a geeky question here I'll pose to you is one of the coolest things I thought about the film early on was just seeing these ships flying through the air. I have to imagine that these vessels that they're on that harken back, of course, to naval ships, that had to be something you were really looking forward to just visualizing on screen.
I kept saying master and commander in the skies, and commander in the skies. The thing is that my agenda all along, because I had spent I spent 30 plus years of my life just wanting to see it. I said, you know, if somebody makes it, I will buy a ticket, I will go. And when I suddenly found myself being the actual person behind making it, I had to kind of put into more concrete definitions and thoughts, into words, the thoughts that had been in my head, the images in my head. And I realized I had always seen it as ancient history. I'd always seen it in my head not as fantasy, but as an undiscovered country, like a continent that we just hadn't discovered yet. That's how the books read. They read like a tourist that had been there and documented everything fascinating that they had discovered with all these details, some that were, you know, understood, some that weren't. But so you kind of bought into this dense and ancient culture. And so I wanted anything that we put on the screen to just give you that transportation. I just wanted it to be a period film of a period we just didn't know about. So that's an easy thing to say, but really tough thing to break down and define once you're really putting this into visual terms. So we spent years with my production designer, Nathan Crowley, and we would have to go, what are the things that make you feel like that? And we finally came to terms on a couple rules. One was like there's sort of this pre-industrial revolution, turn of the century feel to our world where everything was full of a lot of manual labor and everything seemed to be designed based on function, not form. So you could go back even to the first car and you could kind of fix it just by looking at it, you know, figure it out. And you could look at a typewriter, you can kind of figure out how it all works. And the same thing when you look at tall ships, you know, it's all ropes and rigging and wood and slots and turnkeys, but you can kind of tell that everything's there for a reason. There's nothing ornamental. And it's a lot of manual labor in order to make it work. And so it's all very exposed. It's all very dramatic. It's all very physical. And so we just knew that that was the way to go with this world, is keep it in the sort of pre-automization.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar talking to Pixar's Andrew Stanton. His new film is John Carter. And right from the beginning, it opens with some pretty ominous music, and it sets this tone right away. I feel like that this is going to be a mysterious world. There are going to be some dark forces at work, but then it's very clear that you're very determined to make it fun as well, including one very memorable sequence I imagine a lot of people will note involving our main character, where we really get to know something about him in terms of his determination, and it's this escape montage. So I was wondering if you could just talk about how you balance that, the mystery and the darkness of this story with the humor.
Well, I kind of felt the books always had this sincere love of adventure and romance and exploration, but wasn't afraid to have a lot of darkness about, you know, just there's just a lot of fighting and there's a lot of death and there's a lot of things at stake. And in a way, it almost has the same rule book of stakes as a Western. You know, you're just one bad choice away from not surviving. And that to me was just part of its charm of its time period. And I thought if I was a kid in 1976 that could read a 1912 book with that flavor and I liked it for that, then that would, there was no reason to try to modernize or contemporize or change it for that for somebody, for an audience in 2012. I should be delving even deeper in investing in that 1912, sort of undiscovered country aspect of it. And, you know, the humor, I think, is just innate in me. I mean, I'm not like trying to be funny. It's just I can't do things without having some sort of either sarcastic or humanistic sort of point of view about things. And I just feel that it actually, if it's placed well, it makes it more real. It makes it more like life. You know, the humor tends to be right butted up against some real tragedy, and your laughter's not far away from tears. It's all those aspects, and I kind of just never want to give any of that up. I just want to find the right percentages, the right balance for all of that. But I never like to give any of it up.
I was surprised watching it, and as I mentioned, I was brand new to Barzum, that it really is one piece that you could see so many parallels to so many other adventure stories and comic books and comic book movies that have followed, and maybe some obvious ones recently. You can think of some of the parallels with Batman Begins and Star Wars and even The Matrix. I think you can find certain elements in the main characters there. You can go on and on. It's going to inevitably feel derivative for some audiences, even if it is completely the other way around. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I knew that if that was my concern, I should never make it. It was more, again, I know what this is, the Rosetta Stone of so many things, and nobody's ripped it off. Nobody's ever really done literally the scenes from this book or literally taking these characters. It's almost as if, it's like, I don't know how else to put it. It's as if the Beatles music got exclusively listened to by just a small minority of people, and then everybody got inspired and went off and did their own music. But the inspiration you can just sense in what they went off to do. And great art always inspires great art. So I never feel like it's been ripped off or stolen. I feel like you could watch all these things that have been influenced over 100 years together and not feel like anybody's repeating themselves. And that's what gave me sort of the confidence that, like, there was still a place for this original property, for the original Beatles music to just be played and listened to and discovered now.
One of the obvious through lines, as I was thinking about your previous films that you've directed, Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now with John Carter, is you have characters who are trying to get back home. And in the cases specifically of Nemo and John Carter, these are characters plucked from their worlds against their will. And this is kind of a natural hero's journey. It's the stuff of compelling drama. But is there something in particular that draws you to it? And I guess what I'm asking is your next project going to be a remake of The Odyssey?
I think I've done it with this one. Geez.
Yeah.
But I know. I get all this sort of couch analysis after I do these things, and I start finding the patterns that I don't even know about. But I think I'm just always seduced by big and small drama being juxtaposed against one another. And I don't know if it's because when I was a kid, just old enough to be working, I was an usher in a little art house theater that was only open in the summers in the town I grew up in. And so on the weekdays, I'd be seeing things like Breaker Morant three times a day, or Night of the Shooting Stars, or even The Tin Drum, you know, and things I would never choose to see myself, but then being seduced by them. But on the weekends, racing to get in line to go see Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars or Close Encounters. And so I think I've always wanted to have my blockbuster and art house in the same movie if I could get away with it.
You're listening to Film Spotting, talking with Andrew Stanton about his new film, John Carter. And as we were reflecting a little bit, and I was playing therapist, I guess, with some of your other films, you know, something else that occurred to me about WALL-E in connection with this film, and I think I read this quote from you somewhere, that one of the themes of this movie really is a character divided, someone who's really torn between what he should do and kind of what he's born to do. And you think back to WALL-E, yeah. I mean, you can't have a character more divided than that one who's literally trying to buck his programming, and that's what John Carter, to some extent, is doing as well.
I don't know. You could almost argue that that is any good, interesting character, that we're all fighting something about ourselves or adjusting something about ourselves that, whether we're conscious or unconsciously, being resistant. I just think that good stories or good, interesting characters, you drop in at some point where life's suddenly put them into a scenario that they didn't sign up for, you know, whether it's a small thing or a huge world global stakes thing. And I don't know if it just happens to be that it's just coincidence that, you know, I went from something like WALL-E that's forced to kind of go to this primal mythic level because of no dialogue, that you're sort of forced to play with these very base truisms that are very international or just very humanistic and aren't really attached to any modern conventions. And then suddenly I'm picking a book that was written 100 years ago, and the things that have translated or seem to have survived over time are, again, the timeless mythic things about them. I guess that just doesn't surprise me when I look at it that way, that they seem to be similar in nature for those aspects.
We talked a little bit about the influence that Burroughs Stories obviously has had on a lot of art that's followed. And also, you mentioned some of your influences growing up. I'm wondering if you ever watch other films or read other things specifically to prepare or just to be inspired for projects like this. Actually, one film, you mentioned Westerns earlier, one film I couldn't shake as I was watching John Carter was The Outlaw Josie Wales with
God
the Civil War character and what happened to his family. So can you talk about that? Was that an influence?
That was very much an influence. There was two Westerns, that and Jeremiah Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the, and again, we never looked at any movies for narrative reasons. We looked at for tone and for sometimes even just production design, just to kind of be in the same airspace when I was talking to certain heads of departments. We looked at The Last Emperor for the sense of a dying, vast culture that just had a scale that was all, you're always aware of the scale of it being larger than the individuals that were in it. And it was very, impressive, but not necessarily warm, even though there was a ton technically of warm colors used in Last Emperor. And so that was one we looked at as well. And then if you didn't pick up on this, I literally, not only did I look at this, but I even shot in the same locations as Planet of the Apes, and I'm talking the good one with Charlton Heston.
Right.
And there's a couple other now that are sort of eluding me, but those were big ones. Now, Lawrence of Arabia, what am I talking about? We looked at that just because it's the ultimate desert movie.
Sure.
It's my favorite movie of all time.
Really? It is. Talk about that a little bit.
I could do a drinking game with that movie. I think from one line of dialogue to the next line of dialogue, yeah.
I think we should have another episode sometime where we have you on just to do that. I think that'd be great. I'd love to actually continue this discussion forever. I want to close, though, I guess, with this question that actually came from a film spotting follower on Twitter. And I know you are getting a lot of questions about this, comparing this process specifically to the films that were all animation. And I know this was a combination of animation and live action, but the question was, do you find the live action post-production process, including the marketing of it, more challenging than animation?
I don't really find a big difference. And the lines have gotten so blurred over the last couple, maybe just the last decade, with what's computer graphics, what's animation, what's live action, and it's just getting blurrier. You can see it with films of this year, and I think that's appropriate because it's just a tool. But no, I honestly haven't found a big difference there. I really felt like I made two films with this, two productions, an animated film production and then a live action film production in order to get it to look the way that it does. And it called on every single thing I've ever learned to do the animation part of it as well as the live action. And I think you're just going to be probably over time seeing more directors that just, whether they come from the live action side or whether they come from the animation side, having to learn both sides of it to realize a lot of these ideas.
Andrew Stanton's latest film is John Carter, previously directed WALL-E and Finding Nemo, which, Andrew, I have to admit, I've actually admitted it on the show, Finding Nemo was the first film my kids ever became completely obsessed with and watched 1,000 times and quoted incessantly. So I have to thank you for that, and thank you for your time.
I apologize, actually. I apologize for that.
No, I appreciate it. Best of luck with the film.
Sure, thank you. Somewhere
beyond the sea. My thanks again to Andrew Stanton. That was a lot of fun. John Carter is out this weekend in theaters everywhere. And, of course, we'll hear a little bit more from Andrew Stanton later in the Film Spotting Top 5.
I think my favorite thing you pulled out of that interview was his discussing when he was a kid with his brothers and friends that they used drawing things as our currency of getting along, that they needed that. Probably as a father of three boys, you're sensing that already, that boys can need some common interest to keep the chaos at bay.
Absolutely, they do. And books and drawing to a lesser extent certainly is one of them.
And I also liked his pick of Lawrence of Arabia. I don't know why, but I never would have guessed that that would have been Andrew Stanton's favorite film of all time.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have either.
I think we should try to have him back maybe, and we could do a top five desert movies or something like that, and we can get him to explain a little bit more why he chose that as his favorite film.
That's a perfect idea. We've never done top five desert movies, and there have probably been enough that have been set in that environment to warrant a top five. I think we'll have to try to get him back for that. That's a great idea.
Now, we're not artist creations. We're flesh and blood. And we'll do our best to bring some humanity to our performances next in Massacre Theater. Plus, Adam will speak for The Trees and The Lorax. Stay with us. Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog.
Yeah, and Squarespace has been a popular choice of many of our listeners for starting websites or blogs, often, as you might imagine, specifically associated with film content. We've featured many of their sites over the past year or so here on Film Spotting, and there's good reason for it. Squarespace has a lot to offer. They have an easy-to-use interface for creating and managing websites and blogs. They have hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your needs. They actually recently added 13 new template redesigns with 85 new style options and two brand new templates. They also have iPhone, iPad, and Android apps for updating your blog on the go. They offer online resources and a special support team to give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They also offer free live classes now to help all levels of experience get more comfortable with Squarespace. You can build your site, host it, and update it anytime. And Josh, we'll just admit it. Obviously, we started Film Spotting and you started Larson on Film before we knew anything about Squarespace. I wish, actually, I genuinely mean this, I could go back after hearing about all those elements and use Squarespace.
It sounds really easy, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, you can get a free trial at squarespace.com. And that's where you can sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out and you can start building your website. And then if you decide to purchase it, just use the offer code FILM3, F-I-L-M number 3, and you'll get 30% off for 3 months. That's squarespace.com. Use the offer code FILM3. If I had it
All right, tell me what to do.
Okay, you're giving her an injection of adrenaline straight to her heart, but she's got a breastplate, so you gotta pierce through that. So what you gotta do is you gotta bring the needle down in a stabbing motion.
I gotta stab her 3 times.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. A scene from Pulp Fiction, the great Quentin Tarantino film. One of the better films, let's say for now, from the year 1994, and that's going to factor into our poll question here a little bit later in this segment. But now it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a chance at winning the Film Spotting t-shirt of your choice. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Well, well. How long is it?
How long is what?
You know what. How long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda, about 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
Oh, no, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Ah, yes, I would. I'd know you anytime, any place.
Anywhere. Ah, you're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I know that you still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
Yes, I wish you hadn't done that, Hildy.
Done what?
Divorce me. Makes a fella lose all faith in himself. Almost gives him a feeling he wasn't wanted.
That's Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell from 1940's His Girl Friday, not The Philadelphia Story, Josh. A lot of guesses for that film this
week.
Yeah,
I can see that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely Cary Grant, screwball comedy, Katharine Hepburn, though, in that film. His Girl Friday, directed by the great Howard Hawks, written by Charles Lederer, adapted from Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur's play, The Front Page.
And His Girl Friday tied in with our comedy ensemble's theme in Top 5. Alan Jeffrey from Chicago, he explained it really well. This is, of course, the excellent His Girl Friday. The connection to this week's program is the film's inexplicable lack of the Marx Brothers.
That's a shot, Josh.
That's a shot. We're getting a lot of shots.
That wasn't
along
the tie-in,
those lines.
But Alan did have maybe the funniest way of taking a shot at us, so we had to get it in the show. But more directly related to comedy ensembles, Cary Grant, Howard Hawks, and Charles Lederer also collaborated on the movie Monkey Business, I Was a Male War Bride, and Lederer and Hawks did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So a more direct connection to our ensembles. Those three had worked together previously.
We also got this fun email from Rachna from Singapore about His Girl Friday. Rachna says, I watched this movie because of the show. So glad I did. I adore it like I love few other things.
I just love that expression, a way to describe a great movie like His Girl Friday. I adore it like few other things.
Yeah, that's an appropriate way to talk about that film.
It is a great film. Let's go ahead and reach then into the Film Spotting hat. It's not so brimming. I'm a little disappointed. I thought maybe more people would recognize His Girl Friday in my attempt anyway at a Rosalind Russell breakneck speed screwball comedy pace there, Josh. But you reach into the hat and pull out the winner.
The winner is Paul Ranallo from Titusville, New Jersey. Congratulations, Paul.
Congratulations indeed. Paul's been a longtime listener. Glad to see he finally won. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Josh, the generosity of film spotting listeners never ceases to amaze. In addition to a T-shirt for this week's prize, we got this offer from listener Phil Ogden in Bakersfield, California. He's actually going to donate a DVD copy of the Robert Bresson film Ahazar Balthazar. It's the next film in our Bresson marathon. We're going to talk about it next week. He's going to donate a copy of that as well to this week's winner. So.
Isn't that nice? And that's one of the films that some listeners have said have been hard to find.
Yeah.
It's not available in a couple places we usually go to. So extra bonus there.
Yeah, I think Phil really wants to make sure that at least one listener gets to play along. Our thanks to Phil for that. Not going to give any hints here other than to say it does tie in with one of our big topics on this week's show. And we'll note that we did change the character's first and last name, which I think will be pretty obvious as we go through it here.
Is it also a hint to say that I'm extremely uncomfortable right now?
This may be the most uncomfortable I've ever been for Massacre Theater, Josh. Maybe it's just too early in our relationship.
I think it might be.
We've had a few awkward moments, not only the two of us, but former hosts over the years in Massacre Theater. This one might take the cake.
Oh, boy.
It came from Greg Berlin, one of our listeners who's part of our little group called the Film Spotting Advisory Board, a group of six or seven people who have been longtime listeners and chime in with great ideas from time to time. And this was one of his great ideas, and we're going to run with it. So are you ready?
I am.
I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Sorry, Quagmire. Your whole life is just a dream.
Okay, then. If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Beats me. I just work here. Dennis, there's something I want you to know. You're the best assignment I ever had. Really.
I'm honored.
Sure you don't want to? Just for old time's sake? Come on, if you don't trust me, you can tie me up.
I never knew you were so kinky.
Maybe it's time you found out.
And scene. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, March 13th.
Can I go take a shower and then we'll come back and finish the rest of the show? Thank you. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You enjoying this?
Well, it's certainly more enjoyable than my average day. Reading philosophy, avoiding gang rape in the washrooms. Though it's less of a problem these days. Maybe I'm losing my sex appeal.
Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage in a scene from Michael Bay's apparently underrated film, at least according to Josh, The Rock. We did pose to you on last week's show our Nicolas Cage death match. Which film is better, Face Off, directed by John Woo, or The Rock, the Michael Bay movie, which I contended was really Nicolas Cage's first entry into the action genre, and I thought a pretty good one. Certainly, you'd hope that maybe some of the ones that have followed would be a little bit better, up to the quality of a film like The Rock. You're just not buying it, Josh.
I would actually say overrated,
yeah.
The Rock, and
okay.
that's because of the results of the poll.
Well, let's get to that. Yeah. We did pose to you, which film do you like better? Simply pick one. How did it come out?
It came out the wrong way. Face Off, 44%. The Rock, 56%.
I got to be honest with you, Josh. I'm a little bit surprised it wasn't more like 65-35. I really thought The Rock would get more love.
Oh, come on. I am very much questioning Film Spotting listeners after the result of this.
Well, we did get a couple of responses here. This one from John, who said, I thought both movies were awful. I guess that's other in the poll. Choosing which is best is like a Sophie's Choice between children you really wish had never been born. Now, come on. I think that's overstating it a bit, John. And this one from Dennis M., who says, definitively, only one of these films, Josh, has a Criterion Collection release. That should tell you something, and it does.
Which one?
The Rock.
Are you kidding me?
The
what
Rock.
Is going on over there? All right, I need some support. Here's John Semley writing to us. I'm the Toronto editor of the AV Club. There's been an ongoing Cage retrospective here in town, and I've been writing weekly essays on Cage's films and thinking about them and Cage a lot. That said, it is with 100% confidence that I say Face Off is vastly, vastly superior to The Rock. Face Off may well be the best, brainiest American action film ever.
Wow.
If you want to read my sometimes lengthy defenses or derailments in the case of Bay's film, you can find them and we'll link to John's, I'm sure, very excellent and learned
very astute
piece. Oh, my goodness. This guy's got it. And I love that we have the AV Club for these long essays on Nicolas Cage's action films. You know, that's what they're
Who
there
else
to provide
is serving
us.
That need out there.
Exactly.
And, need. And John's a smart guy. He's also the writer who we mentioned previously wrote the primer on Robert Bresson for
See,
the
he's
AV
clearly
Club.
A smart
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, he clearly is a smart guy, and we will link to his articles. I haven't had a chance to read them yet. I really wanted to in preparation for the show, but I also just kind of want to live in denial, and I don't want to accept
you
what
are
John
in denial.
Says. I'm going to accept that The Rock is a much better film than Face Off, and the fact is, film spotting listeners have spoken.
That's true.
Let's get to this week's poll question then. As mentioned earlier in this segment, we're asking you about Pulp Fiction because next week's show is going to be a revival of our year-by-year countdowns. We're going to look at the year 1994, and this is something we haven't done, I think, in at least a year here on Film Spotting. We started with 2004, which is the year before shows began, and we every 6 weeks or so would go back a year and examine that year and pick our five favorite films. We ended at 95. It's time to look at 1994, which really was a pretty notable year. I looked this up just today, Josh, that Forrest Gump not only won Best Picture, it was also the highest grossing film of that year.
Really?
Yeah, and I don't know if that's ever happened in cinema history. My guess is it probably hasn't, actually, that the film that won Best Picture, maybe Titanic
would, yeah,
would be the other clear one. But we certainly don't get that anymore, where everyone talks about the divide between Oscar winners and mainstream.
Definitely.
That was certainly something different then. So we'll see how well Forrest Gump does on our list next week. But to set that up, we just want to know simply, do you think Pulp Fiction was the best film of 1994? Your options are?
Vincent, we happy? Yeah, we happy. Or, no man, I don't eat pork.
We'll obviously have to wait till next week to reveal our answers to that poll question. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. For bonus content this week, we're going to dive into our top five from last week, our comedy ensembles. We joked a little bit about how we were taking a beating for leaving off the Marx Brothers. We did get some really good emails, so we'll respond to a few of those in our bonus content, which you can find on the Film Spotting iPhone app in iTunes or the Film Spotting Android app, which is available in the Amazon App Store. Full information is available at filmspotting.net. And also wanted to throw out a plug for an event that's going on this month at the Chicago Cultural Center. And the main critic responsible is Richard Knight Jr., who's a guy I had a chance to meet for the first time at the Tribune's Oscars event that I did with Tasha Robinson the AV Club. And Michael Phillips was the host of that event. I'd never met Richard before, even though we've been members of the same Chicago Film Critics group for at least a few years now.
We spend a lot of time
together
in the dark, so we don't know what we all look
That's
like.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Had never met him, never had a chance to talk to him. Really interesting guy. And he's got a series going on this month that I think is worth mentioning, Josh.
Yeah, it's the CinemaQ 2 film series. These are free, all these films, and it's their second year outstanding LGBT movies. As you mentioned, Chicago Cultural Center, these are going to be Wednesday night, 6:30. The dates are March 14, March 21, and March 28. And for details, just check out chicagoculturalcenter.org.
Yeah, this series actually started this past Wednesday, March 7th, but three more opportunities to check out those films. We encourage you to do so. Also, I encourage you, if you're interested in studying film a little more maybe in-depth this summer, and who doesn't want to sit in a room on hot summer nights watching movies and talking about films, Josh? But I'm going to be teaching, I think this is my fifth class now at the University of Chicago's Graham School. It's open to everyone. Doesn't matter what your age is or your class standing currently in school, you can take this class, and I'm excited about it because it's one I've wanted to focus on for a while. It's called Cinema Verite, The Documentary and the Problem of Truth, and it's only an 8-week course. It runs from June to August, and as the title says, we're going to focus specifically on Cinema Verite, the direct cinema movement, primarily in the 60s and 70s, and this notion of trying to capture truth as it happens. But we're also going to watch movies from the 80s and 90s, including some of the films from Steve James and Errol Morris and all the big figures in documentary.
So there aren't any prerequisites for this. You don't have to test in. You just sign up, show up, and learn from your wisdom.
I might give everyone a 3-hour exam, a written exam, just to start off the class, but
yes,
I'm an easy grader, Josh.
Okay, so, good to know.
And you have an in. So,
all right. I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And there is full information about this class. And you can actually register now through the University of Chicago's website. If you want more info, you can get that at filmspotting.net.
Okay, that's good.
What? I thought we made a deal last night.
Yes, we did. And I said I wouldn't chop down any more trees.
And I said I was going to keep an eye on you. I'm starving. What's for breakfast?
Josh, we broke format a little bit, starting the show with an interview instead of a full review, and we wanted to get in some discussion of movies currently in theaters, and it makes sense to start with a movie like The Lorax on this show that is devoted to animation. And I had a chance to catch up with The Lorax this past weekend. It was a Kempinar family event. We went and saw this movie. And you're too new to the show, Josh. You haven't really been exposed to just how misguided a childhood I had. I think it's been well established that I was watching R-rated shows on HBO when I should have been reading Marie Sendak. But I do remember my first bookshelf that was jammed full of Dr. Seuss books. Somehow, though, I have no recollection of ever reading The Lorax. Uh-huh. I'm not familiar with the story. I've never read it to my kids. They've read it in school or other places, but I've never read it to them. So I was blissfully able to turn myself over to this movie without really being burdened by the weight of nostalgia. And I think The Lorax is a lot of fun. It could be a little less frenetic. It could be a little less zany in some of the big action scenes. It could be more subtle in its environmental message. Let's just say, if anyone's seen the documentary Jesus Camp, and you remember the mom who's teaching her kids how there's no such thing as global warming and ignore any so-called evidence, if you're one of those people, you're going to be about 20 minutes into this film before you get up and leave. Really,
oh, boy.
I think
okay.
it's that in your face with its message.
Is Al Gore in it?
Al Gore should be in it,
okay.
Certainly.
That's what you're
at
saying.
At this point, yeah. But what I responded to is something we talked about last week when we were just done recording. We were talking about how The Lorax was coming out. We were interested in seeing it. You mentioned how the voice actors seem like such good choices, people who really should be doing a film like The Lorax. And I think that's what I enjoyed the most. The voice work is really good. Danny DeVito as The Lorax just feels right. And you've got the former Daily Show guys, Ed Helms and Rob Riggle. They're obviously talented comedic actors. There's the SNL duo, Nassim Pedrad's in the film, and Jenny Slate, who used to be on SNL. They're very versatile comedic actresses. Stephen Tobolowsky has a small role. And even the teen heartthrobs, Taylor Swift and Zac Efron, are fine. And anecdotally, for whatever it's worth, again, took the entire family to see it. At one point late in the film, the big climactic action scene's going on. My wife nudges me. We look over at my 9-year-old Holden. And he is just entranced by the film. Smile on his face, edge of his seat, just eating all of it up. And my kids all sat there perfectly engaged the entire time. So it gets the Kempinar kids seal of approval anyway. I thought it was a good time.
Nice. I'm going to have to check that out then with my kids. I haven't yet because we did go to the theater catching up with Secret World of Arrietty, which I know you and Michael Phillips already discussed. But that was definitely on my must-see list for this year. And I have to say, I loved it even more than I expected. Being a fan of Miyazaki's films, I know he didn't direct this one, but still has a hand in it. I was looking forward to it, but adapting an English story here, I just thought, how is this going to work? This is just a beautiful film. What I loved about it was how hushed and unhurried it was. Sounds like very different from The Lorax.
Very different
in
than
a lot
Lorax.
Of ways. But that was appropriate to its melancholy story. This is really kind of a somber but not depressing story about this alien boy who discovers these little people living underneath his house. It's such a visual astonishment. And even having seen a lot of Miyazaki films, you think you would get used to this use of nature, but the way it still comes alive in this film is really amazing. There's a scene where Arrietty, the little girl who's the main character, is on top of a roof. She's climbed up there through the ivy. She gets to the top, and the ivy leaves kind of lift in the wind a little bit to reveal this view of the garden. And it's just this beautiful imagery, very impressionistic mm-hmm. and painterly. And when animation is applied to it there, I felt a couple of times it's like this breeze has kind of floated over a Monet painting. So I really fell in love with this film. It actually prompted me to start my 2012 top 10 list.
There you go. It's right now probably at the top of my list as well.
Nice.
Miyazaki, who wrote that film and was kind of a production supervisor, he's definitely going to come up later in this week's
yeah,
top five
so.
As we talk about traditionally animated films. And I guess that brings us back to John Carter, where we started the show talking to the film's co-writer and director, Andrew Stanton. What did you make of John Carter?
It's a huge film.
It is.
I mean, this thing's over 2 hours. It has story upon story upon story, multiple worlds, multiple characters going on. That usually spells disaster. I don't know that here it spells ultimate success, but I think the movie has more personality than you could expect from that description, mm-hmm. from having all of those elements.
Good God. Come on, Mars.
So, now home is Jasun. And you came on one of your sailing ships across millions of carats of empty space?
No. Not like that.
Go on. Shock me. How?
There is a lot of personality, not only in the animation and the characters, the CGI characters, but in the humor that's there and in the design, too. There are a lot of details here in the designs and the creation of this world. And I appreciated that enough to appreciate the film as a whole, even though it has its narrative challenges.
Yeah, I think you summed it up really well for a huge sci-fi action spectacle fantasy film. And it is all of that care and personality that goes into making a movie like WALL-E or Finding Nemo is present here. And I asked him specifically about the vessels in the sky because they are magical to watch. And you get that same thrill here watching those ships as you do watching the best animated fantasy stuff, including the work of Miyazaki, like we see in The Secret World of Eri Eti. It's stuff that only really inventive, creative, imaginative people could offer up. And so you do get those elements here. I think for me, a couple of things that kept me from embracing it as much as I would have hoped, and you touched on it, I actually give Andrew Stanton a ton of credit for culling all that material down into a manageable story that does stand on its own, but it's still unwieldy. There's no doubt about it, especially, I'm guessing, if you're not familiar with the source material, which I wasn't. So that is an obstacle to overcome here. And I'm sure if Andrew Stanton hears this, he's going to shake his head and be disappointed that I didn't recognize the performance here. But Taylor Kitsch, as the main character, as John Carter, he's certainly not giving a bad performance. He's got the hunky warrior thing down. He's got the brooding loner thing down really well. But for a movie with so much humor in it, at times really in-your-face comedy, there was just something lacking for me in his performance. There was a dimension missing, a sense that maybe he was taking it all a little bit too seriously. There's no doubt he's a physical presence on screen, but there was that intellectual kind of ironic dimension that I didn't get that I think the material really needed.
He's certainly upstaged by the CGI creations. Those characters, the aliens, they have more personality in a lot of ways. And it has to do with their animation, not just in their dialogue and stuff either. So yeah, they're a real highlight of the film.
Well, The Secret World of Eri Eti, The Lorax, and John Carter are all out now in theaters. If you've seen any of them and agree or disagree with our takes, you can let us know. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us at twitter.com/filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Well, there'll be no pressure at all as Adam and I compare our top five traditionally animated films with those chosen by WALL-E director Andrew Stanton. I'm going to try to do better than simply offering what he said. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Part of the show where we want to say thanks to all of our very generous Film Spotting listeners for their donations, and also say thanks to Jeff Goldsmith, our partner over at the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, where he interviews screenwriters, also often actors and directors as well. And this week on the Q&A, he's got the New Zealand coming-of-age comedy Boy, and Josh, I'm going to go for it. The writer-director is Taika Waititi, who audiences,
that's exactly right.
Thank you. As you would know, right? Who audiences would be familiar with, Jeff says, from his writing and directing of Eagle vs. Shark and also Flight of the Conchords. Jeff also has on the writer and co-director of Silent House, the new horror film with Elizabeth Olsen. The co-director is Chris Kentis, and the co-writer director is Laura Lau. So good stuff there from Jeff Goldsmith. You can do a search in iTunes or find a link to his show in the notes for our show at filmspotting.net. Our musical guest this week, you're hearing some sounds from an album called Feel the Sound. The band is Imperial Teen. They are a San Francisco-based band, and that's my way, Josh, of just getting another plug-in for the rock.
Oh, it is. Yes.
San Francisco.
I see the connection there.
See it there?
Uh-huh.
Another plug before we get to donations. The guys at Aspect Radio, they're a radio show down in Alabama. They had me on earlier in the week. I've been on a couple times before, and they just wanted me to contribute to their end-of-the-year show where they were looking for their best scene and best performance and best film of the year. So I contributed to that. Encourage you to check that out at aspectradio.net. And we got this note from Carl Gregg in Owings, Maryland, who wrote in and said that with the Bresson Marathon going on, and we've touched on the films that we're screening here in Chicago at the Siskel. Also, we mentioned in Toronto, there were screens going on. Well, it's not an accident. It's not a conspiracy either. Well, actually, it is kind of a conspiracy. He says it may be worth mentioning that the Bresson retrospective is in many cities besides Chicago. For example, Diary of a Country Priest, which we opened the marathon with and is the one marathon film not available on Hulu or Netflix, it's playing in Washington, D.C. for one showing only on March 11th at the National Gallery of Art, and it's free.
Bresson for free on the big screen in a theater. That's worth
go.
A drive if
you
you're anywhere near there.
March 11th, what is that, a Monday or Tuesday night, something like that, but it's coming up, or for those of you listening, well, after the fact, it's just passed. But you should go to our website, though, and in the notes for this show, we'll put a link to where the Bresson films are screening around the country. So I know we have a lot of listeners in D.C. Maybe some of you will get to take advantage of this opportunity, but if you don't live in D.C., there are still other opportunities to see Bresson on the big screen. Again, I encourage you to go to filmspotting.net and click on show 389, and we'll have a link there in the notes. With that, let's get to donations, and we start with a very generous gold-level donor, Laura, in Dade City, Florida.
Laura says, I have a 64-mile trip to work and listen to podcasts, news, and recorded lectures. I live in a town with no movie theater and have not seen a movie in a theater since Toy Story 3.
Wow.
I am indebted to you for broadening my horizons and look forward to the podcasts each week.
I love on our animation show that Toy Story 3 is the last film that she saw in a theater. Thank you for that donation, Laura. And finally, a Silver Club donor, Scott. He's in Dalton, Georgia. Thanks to Scott, Laura, and all of our monthly donors. We don't read our monthly donors every week, the recurring donors, but there are still $2 a month donors out there, $5 a month, and $10 a month. If you are looking for more information about how to donate and support the show, you can go to filmspotting.net and click on the donate link or click on the merch link. You can, of course, buy a Film Spotting t-shirt. That also supports the show as well. Or check out the links of our sponsors, such as Squarespace, of course, who is sponsoring this show. Again, our thanks to everyone who donated this week.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Oh, just leave it to me. What a gown this will be. Oh, it's a beautiful dress. Did you ever see such a beautiful dress? And look, glass slippers.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for the Film Spotting Top 5 this week. Traditionally animated movies. You heard a scene from a great traditionally animated movie there, the great Walt Disney film, Cinderella, which I strongly consider for my list, Josh, really because of nostalgic reasons. I've mentioned it on the show before. Cinderella is the first movie I ever remember going to a theater to see. So it does have a strong place in my heart, but that's how good these lists are. I'm so confident in my five picks. Cinderella couldn't even make the top five.
Yeah, this was really tough to put together. Yeah. I was in actual physical pain doing it.
Yeah, it's tough because obviously we're doing traditional animation, which already narrows down something that's much bigger than that. You're leaving out, and we'll get into this a little bit, films from the past 15 years or so. That's really when computer animation has come to the forefront. So we've tried to segment it down already, but then you could segment it down even further and just focus on the top five Disney films or the top five anime films or even the top five Hayao Miyazaki films if you wanted to get really specific about it. So we did struggle both a little bit putting these lists together, and we had some fun with it because we did get Andrew Stanton, the director of WALL-E and Finding Nemo and the new film John Carter, to weigh in with his picks. We'll hear from him on his top five, but I also solicited picks from some other animation experts.
Hey, Adam and Josh. This is Mike Stern from Los Angeles, California. I'm an animator at DreamWorks Animation. I'm going to weigh in here with my top pick for traditional animated films, and I got to go with a classic and say Dumbo is my number one. I think this film best showcases what animation is capable of, and you know, the two sequences that come to mind are, you know, the baby mind sequence where Dumbo is reunited with his mother, and then the pink elephants on parade sequence that follows. And I think it's safe to say that it's only an animation where you could have, you know, a truly touching scene followed by you know, this bizarre champagne-induced hallucination come to life. So the animation in Dumbo is—it's always inspiring to me. It's great to see that range of styles, you know, playing back to back, and you know, that's why Dumbo is my number one pick.
Look out! Look out! Pink elephants on parade! Here they come! Hippity hoppity! They're here and there! Pink elephants everywhere!
Thanks, Mike, for that great pick. We gave some love to Pixar. Want to try to balance things out just a tiny bit with some love for DreamWorks as well. And Dumbo is obviously a really good choice. And it's great to hear that a film like Dumbo continues to inspire animators like Mike. As we touched on, traditional animation was really the dominant form of animation up until about the mid-90s. I think Toy Story, if my facts are correct, Toy Story was the first film that was all computer generated.
Yeah, it has that legendary reputation as starting it off.
Yeah, so obviously there have been films made since. Some of them may appear on our list that are traditional or classically animated, but really most that you see are computer generated. We're going to go back and recognize some of those traditionally animated films like Dumbo, like Cinderella, and let's go ahead and start with Andrew Stanton's number five.
My number five animated film of all time is an obscure one that almost nobody will be able to find. But it's called Twice Upon a Time. And it was actually redubbed after it failed in the theaters for only a week of its release. And they decided to sex it up for HBO, and they redid all the dialogue and made it R-rated. And believe it or not, the R-rated one is hilarious. And it's one of my, it's a really obscure one. You can probably only find this R-rated version in sort of at Comic-Cons and things like that. You can get a black market one, but I highly recommend it. It's my number five.
I just want to say a few words to you scumbags before you deliver those nightmares. I know some of you have girlfriends and old ladies and all that kind of crap. And you're probably expected to get into their feathers tonight. Well, let me just say, just
I might have to go head to that black market and seek out Twice Upon a Time. That sounds very intriguing.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
R-rated version, of
there
course.
There you go. It has
of
to course. Be the R-rated version. I'm going to follow Andrew Stanton's lead. I have to admit, I wasn't expecting a film I'd never heard of to make his top five, though I guess that stands to reason that he would be pretty immersed in the world of animation.
Sure.
And that one does sound pretty fascinating. It sounds like the kind of movie you'd watch at the Music Box here in Chicago with
yeah.
a big crowd and have
yeah,
some
fun. Yeah, or
Brew
and View, something
yeah,
like Brew that.
Yeah, kind of thing. So that's Andrew Stanton's number five. Josh, what's your number five?
Number five is Beauty and the Beast. Now, The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, I think, were the two high points of Disney's many renaissance that started with 1989's Little Mermaid, usually people point to, and I'd argue it went through Mulan. I really love Beauty and the Beast from that bunch. I'm not especially partial to ballroom scenes, but the one at the end, the dance sequence between Belle and the Beast, is astonishing. They're spinning. The camera is also spinning, and just the technique here, we're spinning in the audience too. It's absolutely magical, and it's one of those movie moments that really sticks with you. I also think Belle is a really unique character when it comes to the Disney canon. A lot of times, Disney will try to go anti-princess by making a princess violent, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. She'll punch someone or something like that, and then she's not being a prissy princess. Belle is something different. She has her own true feminine personhood. And what I mean by that is she has these noble characteristics that are completely apart from the boy-girl dichotomy that we usually get.
Just hold still.
That hurts!
If you'd hold still, it wouldn't hurt as much.
Well, if you hadn't have run away, this wouldn't have happened.
If you hadn't frightened me, I wouldn't have run away.
Well, you shouldn't have been in the West Wing!
Well, you should learn to control your temper. Now hold still. This might sting a little.
I'm really glad to see Beauty and the Beast got some love on your list. Didn't quite make mine, though it is a movie. I mentioned Cinderella and nostalgia. I can also point to a first with Beauty and the Beast, the first movie I believe I ever took my future wife to.
Oh, wow.
It was Beauty and the
Good
Beast.
Choice.
So it does hold a soft spot in my heart as well. My number five, you mentioned something different. Well, I think my number five qualifies. It's actually a 2008 animated documentary called Waltz with Bashir, which, if I remember right, was actually nominated for Best Foreign Language Film from Israel. And I think it won the Golden Globe that year. It's directed by Ari Folman, and it's autobiographical, where It's a story of how he met up with a friend who he served in the Lebanon War with in 1982, and the friend was recounting these horrible nightmares he's having where he's remembering things from the time they served in that war, and Fullman recognizes that he doesn't remember anything. He's completely blocked those experiences out, so then he sets off on this journey to try to fill in the missing spaces and remember what he did during that horrible conflict. And I think the technique here is really fascinating. It looks like rotoscoping, though it really isn't. And there is some computer-generated imagery in this film, but for the most part, it's classically animated. And I did seek out some expert opinions, and they said, no, you can go with it. You should feel safe. It is traditional animation. I think the technique serves a really practical purpose here because as a filmmaker, it's almost impossible for Fullman to go back and recreate these scenarios from the 1982 Lebanon War, including some of the horror of those scenarios. And I think that what he really captures through the animation is the absurdity to war. And we see a lot of surreal sequences that I think you could only get, some of the imagery you could only get from animation. And I also think beyond that kind of practical function, what really fascinated me about it is there is this dissociative aspect to it where Fullman and some of the characters he meets, some of his fellow soldiers, have managed to completely block this out. They've put some distance between themselves and their own experiences. And I think that what the animation does here in this film is it allows us a little bit to dissociate ourselves from the horror. There's kind of a layer where we can be distanced from it and we can see it just through his eyes and these characters' eyes. And I think it's really effective in that way as well. We kind of are able to digest the absurdity of what we're seeing without being just kind of consumed by it, because there is some really tragic events that happen, as you'd expect in wartime. So Waltz with Bashir, maybe a little bit of an odd choice, but my number five.
What I like about Waltz with Bashir is it reopened the possibilities of animation for me again. We get used to what animation, quote unquote, looks like. It looks like Disney. It looks like DreamWorks. It looks like Miyazaki. And here was something that looked completely different with its sharp lines, its rich blacks. I can picture those images right away as you're talking about them.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam and Josh and our special guest, Andrew Stanton, this week sharing our top five traditionally animated films. And let's go to Andrew Stanton's number four.
Number four, it's very tough to pick a favorite Miyazaki film, but the one that I was introduced to, so maybe it's always falling in love with your first, but I find myself always being drawn back to it, is Castle in the Sky. And it was John Lasseter that introduced that to me when we were first making Toy Story and giving us an example of just how to intro a movie.
Well, Mr. Stanton's right about a lot of things. He's certainly right that it's tough to pick a favorite Miyazaki film for this list. He went with Castle in the Sky. And of course, thinking back to the Toy Story films, he's absolutely right. You think how they start those movies with these great sequences, not unlike Star Wars, where they just throw you right into the action, right into kind of a battle scene or something where you haven't really gotten to know these characters yet, but you're just enmeshed in this world. That's how the Toy Story films begin, and they did maybe take their cue a little bit from Castle in the Sky. It's a great film. Josh, what's your number four?
Well, I'm going to get to Miyazaki, but not at number four. Number four, I have The Illusionist from French animator Sylvain Chomet. Chomet's better known for the triplets of Belleville, but I was actually more taken with this 2010 effort. It's about an aging vaudeville-style magician whose act has kind of gone out of vogue in 1950s Europe. These screeching rock bands are taking over the concert halls, and he really has nowhere left to go. This was based on a script by the late Jacques Tati, who's one of my personal favorites, and their sensibilities here turn out to be a really good match. Chomet has this empathetic eye for human frailty. You really see that, I think, in Triplets of Belleville, too. And Tati has this witty skewering of human folly. And those two things complement each other beautifully in this tale. I also had to pick it for this list because we talk about traditional animation as a fading art form, I think, one that's going out of style, certainly, maybe going out for good. Sometimes you wonder. And so if that happens in 10, 15, 20 years, I like to think of The Illusionist as one of those lovely swan songs to the art form.
It is a really lovely, cute, sweet film. And I think I'm with you. I think I maybe like it better than The Triplets of Belleville as well. So I'm glad to see it there on your list. My number four, I am going to stick with Hayao Miyazaki. I'm going to follow Andrew Stanton's lead. And as I said, it's so tough because I love Castle in the Sky. He has other very good films like My Neighbor Totoro, Ponyo, one of his recent films, is good as well. Probably my favorite first half of any Miyazaki film is Princess Mononoke. But if I'm going to pick my favorite, I'm going to go with my first, and it's Spirited Away, a 2001 film where you have a 10-year-old girl who's kind of despondent. She's moving to a new neighborhood. She's not really getting along or connecting with her parents, and she gets thrown into this alternate reality. and her parents are transformed into pigs by a witch, and she's basically spending the rest of the film trying to find a way to free herself and get her parents back to normal and go back to her real life. Of course, as I say that, it probably sounds a lot like Alice in Wonderland. It probably sounds a lot like Wizard of Oz. And I think probably by design, it's a really fascinating coming-of-age story. And Miyazaki just is so good at creating these elaborate, self-contained worlds that are full of their own mythologies, but they tap into our own actual cultural myths and fears. And what you have to have in any animated film, memorable characters, memorable sequences, the bathhouse at the center of Spirited Away is really a sight to behold. And a character like No Face, the monster who shows up with his appetite, where he just keeps feeding and feeding and growing and growing, those images really stick with you long after the film ends. So Spirited Away is my number four. Before we get to Andrew Stanton's number three, let's hear from a listener who knew we were doing this top five, wanted to weigh in with, what's fair to say, an offbeat choice.
Hi, Josh and Adam. This is Baird from Oak Park, Illinois, and I have a suggestion for your top five traditional animation films, although it's not that traditional, but it has all the markings of a traditional film. And that is The Yellow Submarine, featuring the Beatles, although they don't actually star in it. But it has all the elements that you would need in a classical animation film. It's got the good versus evil, and who else could be more evil than a bunch of blue meanies? It's got Beatles music. You can never go wrong with that. And also, most importantly, it's a 90-minute history lesson showing the impact of the psychedelic era on the media and on the culture of the time. It was one of my kids' most favorite movies, which they enjoyed much more than the Disney ones. And it's a movie that even today you can look at and just be amazed of the color and the animation and just the joy of the Beatles.
We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine.
Thank you, Baird, for that pick of The Yellow Submarine, a film I don't think I've ever seen from start to finish, but I love that idea that that was the film of all the movies, all the animated films his kids watch growing up. Yellow Submarine was the one they were most into, but the Beatles probably did have something to do with that.
Yeah, probably.
Music. Well, let's go to Andrew Stanton's number three traditionally animated film.
Number three is, we're getting really traditional now, number three is Jungle Book, the Walt Disney version. That really got me into wanting to be an animator. I think the best voice to animation, actor voice married with animation I've ever seen still to this day, is George Sanders playing Shere Khan the tiger in Jungle Book.
Oh, now what? I'll be right down. Yes, yes. Who is it?
It's me, Shere Khan. I'd like a word with you, if you don't mind.
Shere Khan. What a surprise.
Yes, isn't it?
Well, you talk about your important animated films. Andrew said The Jungle Book was probably the film that really inspired him to want to be an animator. That's really all you need to know right there. We might hear more about The Jungle Book here in a second, but Josh, what's your number three?
Well, you've had your say about Miyazaki, and so has Andrew, so now it's my turn. It's interesting, both of you mentioned the one that you saw first, and how that stuck with you. Same case for me. So maybe there's something about encountering this new world, this new style of animation that you just can't shake. Mine at number three is Princess Mononoke. And this is a fantasy echo fable. It's about a prince who tries to broker peace between these protective animal gods of the forest and then the human marauders who are devouring the land in the name of progress. You might think that sets up a very simple good versus evil dichotomy here, but what's really interesting about this film is how it emphasizes the holistic reality of nature as opposed to that sort of good versus evil setup. The forest gods are not pure good. They can become enraged, scary demons who do terrible things. And then you have this Lady Eboshi, who's this provocative character in that she's this iron magnet, a warrior, and she's leading these people against these forest gods. But she also takes prostitutes and lepers under her care. So she has this gentle touch to her, too. Now, the richness of this imagined universe, I would say, is of Star Wars quality. And you know by now I mean that as a compliment. You've never seen anything so lovingly imagined as this. As a matter of fact, the misty clouds here and the way they just drift across the screen, that's enough for me to put this film on my list.
Yeah, Princess Mononoke is really good. As I mentioned, it's probably my favorite first half of any film. that Miyazaki did. There's just something about meeting that character, Ashitaka, who is our hero, and the demons and the mythology of that world, and meeting characters like Lady Eboshi. I was really into it. And then you're right, there's nothing simple about this world. The second half, it gets really complex. There is nothing cut and dry about who's good, who's bad, and it goes into some pretty fascinating, detailed places. And that's what I love about it. But I also really responded to the directness of the first half of the film as well. My number three, well, Andrew Stanton stole my thunder a little bit. I'm actually going to go with The Jungle Book as well. It's so hard to pick just one Disney movie, as we've established. But The Jungle Book is one I didn't discover until my first child was born. And my wife was always fond of it, so we bought it and we watched it quite a bit when Holden was younger. But there's some great comic relief in the form of Baloo the Bear. There's great music. Bear Necessities is obviously amazing song. I love the villains. You got to have great villains in an animated film. And you have Ka the Snake and Shere Khan. Obviously, Andrew Stanton's right about George Sanders' vocal performance. There's just something so refined about him that he's able to kind of trick you. He's able to kind of bring you in, and you really do think he might be looking out for Mowgli. And, of course, there's something more to it. There's something ulterior in his motives. And it reminded me, actually, of The Lion King. And,
sure.
Yeah,
yep.
Jeremy Irons as Scar, where you've got this great British actor delivering those lines with that booming voice. There's actually, the more I thought about it, a lot of similar elements between The Jungle Book and The Lion King. I'm sure many people have pointed that out. I think even Bear Necessities is similar to Hakuna Matata. The songs express some of the same sentiments. Forget about your worries and your strife, the Bear Necessities. So I love The Jungle Book. I was glad to see it on Andrew's list. It's my number three as well.
Oh, this is the night. It's a beautiful night. And we call it a bella notte.
Number two is for just pure, solid story from beginning to end is Lady and the Tramp. That's one of those that I can sometimes forget about, but then I remember, and then I go and watch it, and I'm just completely transported. A lot of people don't know it was originally shot in CinemaScope. It is a 70mm film that is very widescreen, so make sure that now they've sort of restored it all, so I think if you get the Blu-ray, you won't get ripped off and see the horribly cropped version.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Andrew Stanton, the director of WALL-E, Finding Nemo, and the recent John Carter, chimes in with his number two all-time favorite traditionally animated film. It is the great Disney movie, The Lady and the Tramp. That's one I need to watch with my kids as well. I don't think we've had a chance to see that one yet.
Oh, my daughters adore that
film. Do they?
Yeah, yeah. And I think as he talks about the storytelling, you can see how that does work on an audience and just sweep you up into the tale. That makes a lot of sense.
What about your number two, Josh?
I'm going to go Disney as well, and a historical pick here, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. This was Disney's first animated feature in color, and they also use these larger animation cells to capture new levels of detail and depth. So there are a lot of reasons to put this on the list that are kind of technical and historical, but I think it's worthy of inclusion for other merits as well. We're really lucky when you think about Disney incorporating the Grimm fairy tales and how he would continue to do so, that right at the beginning, he wasn't afraid of the darkness. He didn't feel the need to sanitize these often horrific tales. So in Snow White, we have trees that are clawing at her, those yellow eyes that glow menacingly in the dark. Like Bambi, which comes 5 years later, Snow White upholds that sort of fairy tale vision of the forest as this place of both danger and wonder. So you add all this up, and I think what you have very early on is one of the first instances where a children's movie gave kids the level of artistry that they really deserve, which doesn't always happen today.
No, it doesn't. And you're right that there are some really scary elements in that film that you don't see with a lot of kids' movies today. Miyazaki will go there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those old school Disney films will certainly go there. I think we'll hear a little bit more about that as we go through our list. My number two, I'm going to give some love to Andrew Stanton's partner at Pixar, Brad Bird. And the film is The Iron Giant, a movie that was part of Film Spotting's animation marathon, along with Spirited Away back in 2006. It's set in the 50s, a little town called Rockwell, Maine. You have a young boy named Hogarth who meets an iron giant. He's a robot who crash landed from outer space, and they befriend each other and basically spend the rest of the film trying to evade the U.S. military. And one of the things I said then about the film, I had such a strong reaction to when I saw it for the first time, that I put it up there with the best stuff I'd seen from Pixar, like Toy Story, like Finding Nemo. It's obviously an incredibly moving film, an emotional film, but it makes a very powerful statement as well against violence and against war. And what I like about it is it's nuanced enough where it's not just this blanket anti-military, anti-government kind of statement. It's really against fanaticism and the perils of paranoia that we see in the Kent Mansley character in the movie. But of course, Brad Bird isn't really focused on those kind of political statements. This movie really shows some nostalgia for its time and place, which I love the fact that it goes back, even though it could have been computer-generated, and the giant is computer-generated. Everything else is hand-drawn, and he kind of pays homage maybe to his predecessors, some of those Disney classics, by making the movie in 2D. And I thought a lot, of course, as you watch it, I think a lot of people do, of E.T. with this movie. In some ways, the stories are really similar, but the time and the setting and the characters absolutely make the Iron Giant unique. So it's my number two.
As you're talking about it and referencing the influences, it makes me think that this is something like the Super 8 of animation.
Yeah.
In the way it artfully weaves together all of these elements that came in really good movies before to make a great piece of animation itself.
I think that's a great point. It's time in the Film Spotting Top 5 where we reveal our number one picks for traditionally animated movies. Here's Andrew Stanton with his number one.
My number one, I think it's a little obvious because you can see its influence all over the place in Finding Nemo, was Bambi. Bambi was one of the first animated movies I ever remember seeing, but I also feel it's the most lyrical, it's the most impressionistic of all Walt Disney's films. And it's also probably, in a weird way, the most human. It really kind of cuts to the core of just life in general and doesn't shirk from anything, whether it's the mother's death to just the joy of spring. And it'll always be my favorite.
That was exactly what came to mind during the first minutes of Finding Nemo is, whoa, Bambi.
Really?
Not only just that a similar thing happens, but that you felt the emotion and it was setting up a tale that you're going to become really involved in. So that makes complete sense that
yeah.
you would pick that as his number one.
It really does make sense. And after Andrew gave us that pick, I told him, I'm probably going to have to watch Bambi with my kids this weekend because I don't think I've seen it since I was a young kid. And I know that my kids haven't seen it. And we did watch it this past weekend. One of the things that really struck me about it, and I wonder how much this is true of some of the older Disney films if I went back and revisited them, is Bambi really doesn't have any plot. It's all story.
No.
It's all story. It introduces you to Bambi. It introduces you to the world, the supporting characters, the people who inhabit his world. Yes, something happens to his mother. Yes, there's some action at the end, but there isn't really any kind of chain of events. There's no larger goal. It's just a coming-of-age story. It's about this character growing up.
The narrative is driven by the seasons.
It is. That's it.
It's pastoral. It's a work of nature,
yep.
and it captures that sort of rhythm.
Well, Bambi's obviously a great choice. Josh, what about your number one?
Well, I'm going to let Josh Spiegel introduce the number one because, very smart guy, we had the same one.
Hey, Adam and Josh. It's Josh Spiegel from the Masterpiece Cinema Podcast, calling in with my pick for the best ever traditionally animated movie. Because I run a Disney movie podcast, which your listeners can find on iTunes or soundonsite.org, it'll come as no surprise that my pick is one of the all-time Disney classics, 1940's Pinocchio. Pinocchio has most hallmarks of a great Disney film: memorable music, beautiful and strikingly colorful animation, a clear and important message to kids, and comic relief from animal sidekicks. But what makes Pinocchio stand out for me is its ability to tap into a child's various primal fears. So much of the story is about the little wooden boy overcoming intense and often terrifying adversity, from escaping the clutches of an evil puppeteer, to avoiding a sniveling fox, to facing off against Monstro the Whale. Though Walt Disney and his animators were imparting serious morals to youngsters through these scenes, what they do first is scare the living daylights out of us. Even as an adult, the sequence where Pinocchio watches, horrified, as bad boy Lampwick transforms into a donkey for being such a troublemaker is more frightening than most horror movies, past and present. As powerful now as it was when I was 5, Pinocchio is the best traditionally animated movie I've ever seen. Thanks, guys.
Number one picks often come down to very personal reasons rather than historical ones or ones of artistry. And so Pinocchio is the Disney film that, the traditionally animated film, I'll just say, that I most adore. What I appreciate about this film and what scares me about this film is the way it captures the terror that moral decisions can present for little kids. So whether or not you steal that cookie in the kitchen, when you're little, that seems like a matter of life or death, making
yeah.
that decision. Pinocchio captures that. And it does so with possibly the greatest cast of villains in an animated movie. We've talked about some wonderful villains already, but here you've got Honest John, who's the smooth-talking fox who convinces Pinocchio to skip school, Stromboli, the puppeteer who kidnaps him, the coachman who lures Pinocchio and the other boys to Pleasure Island. What a terrifying place. And I haven't even touched on Monstro the Whale yet.
He's coming! get it, son!
So all of these characters are there to kind of take Pinocchio through this moral journey. Now, the movie's mantra, it's harsh, but it's instructive. It really is. Share, don't lie, be brave. That's what it encourages, or else.
I think you see that probably as well in my number one pick. Obviously, Pinocchio, a very good choice. Another one I'd love to revisit, one I haven't seen since I was a kid. But my number one's going to give me an opportunity, Josh, to do something that I've wanted to do for a while, which is anoint another film into the film spotting pantheon. And I think longtime listeners of this show can probably say these four words with me. My number one is Grave of the Fireflies, another Japanese animated film from Isao Takahata. It came out in 1988 from Studio Ghibli, which is also Miyazaki's production house. And it focuses on a pair of orphans in World War II Japan named Seita and his younger sister Setsuko. They lose their mother in the bombing of their town and their father's away with the Navy. And the movie is essentially their struggle to survive. That's what Grave of the Fireflies is. And something about the interaction between the brother and sister, the scenes of them playing together, of her enjoying the fruit drops, their happiness together is somehow really transcendent. And I think the animation here, kind of like with Waltz with Bashir, really helps us because it captures a beauty that I think normal photography maybe couldn't, but it also makes things a little more heightened and less realistic, which we need because there's so much suffering in this film that you need that distancing a little bit. I think if this was almost a neorealist film, it would just be unbearable. You literally couldn't watch more than about 30 minutes of it. So as much as I love this movie, I do warn listeners that when this film was first discussed on the show, if you haven't seen it yet, I said this, part of me actually wishes I could block it out of my memory. I wish I could kind of go back and go to an easier time when I hadn't suffered with Setsuko and Seita. But it's so beautiful, and why it needs to go into the film spotting pantheon, I think evidence here of its greatness, but also why it's such a movie that I think of in conjunction with this show. Back when we did our top five poverty movies, it was the Grave of the Fireflies memorial list. It was my number one tearjerker. It was my number two movie about mortality. It was my number two movie that begins with the end. It was my number two movie to teach an alien about Earth, Josh. That will be a fun one to revisit someday with you. And it was my number one film spotting discovery. The film that, because of this show, I hadn't seen before. I discovered it because I did film spotting. And it was my number one. It was the movie that had the biggest impact on me.
Yes, I think it is time for you to move on. That sounds appropriate.
So with that, we'll go to E.T. We'll go to our Pantheon theme music and officially induct Grave of the Fireflies into the Pantheon.
I'll be right here.
Goodbye, Grave of the Fireflies. I'll miss you. With that, we go to some honorable mentions. And Josh, we've had a lot of animated films come up in this segment, but were there any that were really hard to leave off?
Just about everything on both Andrew's list and yours would have been an honorable mention. I'd add Peter Pan, which I gave real consideration to. I also did think about South Park and The Simpsons, the feature versions mm-hmm. of those television shows. It was partly that they were TV shows first, but it's also that their visual artistry is undeniably lacking. Now, I think The Simpsons has a lot of visual wit in the details, but it's not at the level of these films we're talking about.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And also that most of my honorable mentions were mentioned at some point throughout the segment there, but a few that maybe weren't. I love, speaking of nostalgia, Pete's Dragon. Going back to that old school film. And, you know, a lot of people rip on the Don Bluth era of Disney, and probably rightfully so. But I actually really responded to The Secret of Nim. I think that's a good film.
There was a lot of Don Bluth response. I asked on Twitter and Facebook for suggestions because I was really struggling with this topic. And I got so much Don Bluth, I would have never even considered it.
Yeah.
And I haven't really explored all of his stuff. It's mostly what I remember from my childhood, which I don't remember as fondly as mm-hmm. some of these other films.
No, I think The Secret of Nim is definitely worth seeing or revisiting. And also, I'm a big fan of Watership Down, another movie about a lot of suffering, but a very good one at that. So those are our top five traditionally animated movies. Our thanks again to our special guest and to Andrew Stanton, of course, for his picks. Tell us what we got right, tell us what we got wrong or overlooked by emailing feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us at twitter.com/filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Well, as we try to look at what we learned on this episode of Film Spotting, where we focused on traditionally animated films, we learned that The Rock is better than Face Off.
I didn't learn that.
No, you didn't?
I know.
We learn that John Carter is unwieldy, but has some redeeming elements for sure. And also that there are a lot of amazing traditionally animated films out there. I don't know how else to sum that up. We mentioned probably about 25 movies. Opening wide this weekend, John Carter, the new Andrew Stanton film, opens Silent House. This is the new film from Martha Marcy May Marlene star Elizabeth Olsen. It's a horror movie, and the new Eddie Murphy comedy, A Thousand Words. In limited release, Being Flynn opens. This stars Robert De Niro and Paul Dano. Friends with Kids, John Hamm in that film. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. This is Ewan McGregor and Emily Blunt, I believe, in a romantic drama. And Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which is a Turkish crime drama directed by Nuri Bilge Ceylan. Michael Phillips, our occasional contributor here on Film Spotting, loves Nuri Bilge Ceylan and really likes this film. So it's one I want to see.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to that for a long time. It's been playing at festivals and I've heard nothing but really exciting things about it.
Well, next week here on the show, I don't know if we'll get into any discussion of Anatolia. We may not have time, but I'm going to try hard to fit in a screening. We will discuss Being Flynn, the new film with Robert De Niro, and we'll get back to our year-by-year countdown with the top five films of 1994, and also the fourth film, the penultimate movie, in our Bresson Marathon, Ahazard Balthazar.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and PA Tessa Tereskin. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured music was Imperial Teen. You can learn more about them at imperialteen.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.